the meeting of the Education Committee, it's the Education Subcommittee on Education Innovation, to order. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2612. Before we get started, though, I would like to remind people, if you have a cell phone and it's in the on position, it does affect our equipment, even if it's not ringing. It affects the equipment, and so it's best to have them in the off position completely. Secondarily, I want to thank Chair Comp for giving me the opportunity to be the chair today. So I appreciate that opportunity, because this is some important stuff for me personally. So thank you very much. With that, we'll have a short statement. Okay. And then,
thank you, Chair. In front of you are the staff measure summaries for the bills we're hearing today, 2612, 13, and 14. Normally, the administrator would give a summation of the bill, but given the kind of length and complexity of them, the chairs agree that we'll defer to the people who are the requesters of the bill, the chalkboard project people who will be coming up first. Just to make sure then you're aware that attached to 2612 is a revenue impact statement, which is draft, and then attached to 2614 there is a no revenue impact statement attached, and that's we're able to make a change in the staff measure summary on that. And then these bills do have referrals to revenue. Well, two of them have ways and means referrals. One has revenue, then ways and means, and that's stated at the bottom. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. So we'll begin on House Bill 2612 with the chalkboard project. It will Sue Hildick and Charlie Walker. Anyone else coming up with you, Sue? Oh, and John. Come on up, all of you. And if you didn't put your name on the list so that we can have it, please, when you announce yourself, make sure you spell your name, especially if it's one of those that's difficult to spell. And proceed.
Representative Roblin and committee members, my name is Charlie Walker. I live in the village of Neskowin on the Central Oregon coast, and I'm here today because I chair the board of the Chalkboard Project. First and foremost, I'm a teacher. Began teaching in 7th and 8th grade, and over the years of my career have moved to teaching various levels, including college and graduate school. As chair of the board of the Chalkboard organization, I believe you already know, but I probably should say, that we have spent the last 3 1/3 years doing research on best practices in K-12 education throughout this country and in other English-speaking nations. We've also listened to almost 100,000 Oregonians tell us what they believe are the important elements to address in K-12 education. Now, as a result of that 3 1/3 years of work, we begin today by presenting several bills. And I just want to be clear on why we've become involved.
Okay.
We've become involved because, as representatives of five of the more major charitable foundations in Oregon, we've gotten asked for more and more money to invest it in K-12. And we've done that. But we've also, in that process, become able to see K-12 through eyes that we didn't earlier have. For example, some of the things that concern us. Oregon class sizes are among the highest in the nation. Our state's dropout rate is among the highest in the nation. Our students' reading and math achievement gains are modest at best, and there is dramatic drop-off in achievement levels between the elementary and the middle school. Nearly 40% of our new teachers choose to leave teaching within the first 5 years of their work in Oregon. That's a very high percentage. States around us, it's more like 5 or 10%. Recently read a national study that pointed out that 25% or almost 25% of the students who enter high school in Oregon never graduate from high school in Oregon. Our school's funding system has been labeled as one of the most unstable in the country. More than half of Oregonians suspect that there's waste and inefficiency in our schools. And overall, our performance is about middle of the pack nationally when compared with other states. We believe that a time is here now. We believe at a time that occurs only once in a very, very, very long time is here. When Oregonians are saying what they want, when we can show what best practices delivers results, and that's what's emboldened us and put us in the position of wanting to put specific pieces of legislation before you. We're in the wonderful position, which you know far better than I, of having a bit more money to spend. But we're convinced that spending more money is not sufficient. That more money has to be targeted to direct programs to produce a higher level of student achievement. And that's the bottom line for Chalkboard. We're up to one thing and only one thing only, and that is to try to help lift K-12 student level of learning up to the point of where it compares to other states in the top 10 in the nation. That's all we want to do. It's a gigantic task, but we want to be a helper, a collaborator, a partner in the process of doing that. Now, I want to make just a personal statement about where I am as an individual. Without achievement of that goal, that one goal of lifting level of student learning here so that it is among the top 10 in the nation on all measurable criteria, without doing that collaboratively, Oregon is destined, in Charlie's judgment, to be an economically strained, mediocre or average, slightly backwater state with limited creativity and opportunity for all of us. That's what drives me. I don't want that. I want to be sure that's not the case. And we have an opportunity. And Chalkboard is prepared to be a partner in providing that opportunity. I thank you for your help in the past. Some of you are among the 100,000 that we connected with, and hope to try to be responsive to your questions in the future. Thank you.
I think we'll let each of them speak before we have questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sue Hildick, and I'm the president of the Chalkboard Project, and we're really grateful that you are hearing our bills today. And what we want to do is walk you through the details. But first I would like to say a couple of things that span all three bills. These bills each attempt to walk the very fine line between state leadership and the local control necessary to implement meaningful reforms in each school district. And you know that is a very fine line. We believe the state has a responsibility as the major funder of Oregon schools to direct its investment in strategic ways and to measure the results of that investment and give Oregonians back the results. We also know that local districts need flexibility to meet the unique student challenges they face. And that, again, is part of the balance and the struggle that you're working with and we've been working with in the 3.5 years we've been looking at this issue. Secondly, we want you to know that these bills reflect our best thinking, and we believe they advance the goals of Chalkboard's plan, but we are wedded only to those goals, not to the means. We're very open on the details about how we get there. We invite improvements to these bills, and we look forward to working with all partners to make them as strong as possible. So to start off, I think you have House Bill 2612 before you, and this bill is about prioritizing funds to maximize student achievement results. As Charlie stated, that is our overarching goal. This bill addresses a key problem for Oregon, and it's making sure that all children get off to a good academic start in school. I think you all know we've been through a process of exhaustive research, and we found, disappointingly, very few best practices, very few gold standards in K-12 around the country and nationally and internationally where we could really say these are proven to move the bar. But two of the ones we did find center on the early learning years. And remember, we looked at K-12. We didn't consider pre-K. But in K-12, what we found was lowering class sizes in kindergarten and first grade and expanding the use of one-to-one reading tutors in K-3 are the interventions that stand apart from all the others. To the degree in which they have been researched and to the degree that they have ultimately proven to drive student achievement results. One fact stands out. Children who don't read at grade level by the end of third grade will likely never catch up, and they're far less likely to graduate from high school. And we have an issue in Oregon. According to one national measure, and we look at NAEP, the National Assessment for Educational Progress, only about one-third of Oregon's third and fourth, one-third of Oregon's fourth and eighth graders are proficient at reading. We realize those numbers vary significantly from state to state, but they are the only measure that we have to compare ourselves to other states. And we even know that they look a little different than state test results, but still even there, it's not unusual to see a dramatic drop-off in achievement, 20 to 30 percentage points, as elementary students move to middle school. So on the issue of K-1 class size reductions, our research shows several things. First, that getting below the 20 student per class threshold is key. The most studied effort around this in Tennessee showed that lowering class sizes to an average of 15 students provided those students with achievement gains that persisted over time. And that's the key, achievement gains that persisted over time. There's no evidence that lowering class sizes in higher grades has that kind of lasting impact, and that's why it's risen to the top of Chalkboard's list. And one final point there is that research shows that K-1 class sizes at that level will benefit all students in terms of achievement growth, but particularly low-performing and at-risk students will benefit the most. And in terms of reading tutors, we know that Oregon's own SMART program has already shown that participants make a significant improvement in reading, and there are other programs as well that have shown dramatic success to support youngsters as they're learning to read. We haven't specified what method schools need to use to provide that reading support. We think there's lots of ways to do that, paid tutors, volunteered tutors, other kinds of programs. But what we want to see is a focus on reading support for any child not reading at grade level in K-3. So specifically, House Bill 2612 would create a student achievement fund and would prioritize funds to districts to invest in proven practices that raise student achievement. ODE would approve proposals that are likely to attain academic performance targets and would report to the legislature annually on the uses and outcomes of the funds provided. The bill appropriates $35 million for early age initiative grants to districts beginning in the 2008 and 09 school year. That's broken out at approximately $24 million to start to phase in the K-1 class size reduction to 15 to 17 students in up to a quarter of the state's schools, and $11 million to provide reading support to K-3 students who are reading below grade level. Our intent is that the 08-09 school year is just the start, and the grant program would expand over subsequent years. And that's when we would be looking for additional funds around middle and high school reforms and also full day K. We will also be supporting a capital package to help school districts meet their capital needs as we do this kind of class size reduction. We're working with Dave Hunt on the options there. An important note about these grants, to sum it up, targeting is critical to us. Other legislative proposals that will come before you are open-ended, and they allow districts to choose between a dozen or so interventions. We see two major problems with that approach. First, there's no assurance that districts will implement the approaches that research say matters most. And second, by allowing districts to go in so many different directions, how will Oregon be able to tell which of the interventions worked best? That said, local districts need flexibility, and this bill incorporates options for schools to invest in other research-based methods to raise student achievement if they already have in place a class size reduction program and a reading support program assisting all eligible children. The difference between our proposal and others is that these alternative investments are exceptions, not the rule. If we know that K-1 class size and reading support make the biggest difference in helping students achieve long-term gains, why would we not make those our funding priorities? Mr. Chair, I am happy to go on to the other two bills if you'd like us to, or do you want to take them one at a time?
What I will do is I will open, it might be easier this way for other people too, because I think there's people who want to respond to each one as well. So we'll open a public hearing on 2613 and open a hearing on 2614 at the same time. So.
Thank you. So House Bill 2614 is about supporting Oregon's educators more effectively. It proposes an innovative, bold approach to strengthening Oregon's educators so that they can maximize student achievement results. This bill addresses the fact that Oregon is one of only a few states with no statewide system to ensure high-quality, job-embedded professional development for educators. Oregon currently spends more than $50 million a year for professional development, yet we lack standards or outcome measures for those dollars and quality assurances. We can't continue to leave the quality and relevancy of ongoing professional support for our teachers up to chance. Our research shows, and you know this, that teacher effectiveness is the single biggest factor influencing student achievement gains. And when professional development for educators is focused on the most effective or needed instructional practices, student achievement can increase by as much as 20%. In addition to teacher and principal mentoring, which is this topic of a separate bill that Chalkboard is partnering with Stanford Children on, we think that there's another key investment the state needs to make. We convened a group of educators a year and a half ago and asked them to consider all the issues around teacher quality, and they told us that the number one priority was to improve the quality of and delivery system for ongoing professional development for educators. Educators across the state have told us they want more time to collaborate and learn from their peers, that they want thoughtful and tested professional development coursework, and they want an investment in continuous learning similar to other professions. So this bill establishes the Oregon Collaborative for Educational Excellence to provide an infrastructure for research and standards-based professional development for teachers and administrators. Now, it's important to note that we're not proposing a large new bureaucracy, no new big state agency, no new bricks and mortar building. We are also not proposing a new regulatory agency. What we are wanting to create is an independent public-private partnership with a mission to coordinate effective professional development. We see this as a new and important opportunity for Oregon to really strengthen the professional development work that's going on. We would like to create a professional learning network with regional centers across Oregon and a web-based virtual learning opportunity. We see this entity as setting quality standards based on national standards for professional development that are linked to increasing student achievement. We see this entity as providing quality assurances for professional development providers and advancing research-based best practices. The collaborative, as we have currently proposed it, would be governed by an 11-member board appointed by the governor and the state superintendent and advised by two statewide committees of educators and stakeholders. Higher ed would be included at the table because for too long, teacher preparation has been separated from teacher professional development, and we need to bridge that gap. The board would be accountable to the joint boards of education and the legislature. And this bill finally provides funding to launch the collaborative in the next biennium. The third bill that we're bringing forward to you today is House Bill 2613. This bill is about maximizing our dollars for teaching and learning by ensuring best business practices are being used by schools all across Oregon. As you know, many Oregonians don't currently believe that our schools are spending their money efficiently. And Chalkboard's research shows that while many schools are running efficiently, our evidence indicates the state could do more to decrease non-instructional spending. And that's what this bill is about. Let's just touch on a few facts first. First, Oregon spends well above the national average on other support services. We spend $453 per student compared to the U.S. average of $278 per student. Now, what's included in this category? This category generally includes the cost of business-related operations, including hiring, payroll, purchasing, warehousing, and technology services. But it also includes spending on permanent early retirement programs. And these programs made financial sense at one time, but today seem to be draining away important resources that could be better funneled to direct classroom support. The second fact is through our open-ended match program, Oregon is spending $656 per rider to transport students to and from school. That's $48 more per rider than Washington, a state that faces many of the same geographic challenges that Oregon has. Under our current transportation formula, the state covers 70 to 90% of a district's transportation expenses, which leaves districts with almost no incentive to look for more efficient ways to do busing. Along with these facts, we're concerned about public perception. Not only 40% who believe schools may not be spending their money efficiently, 55% believe there's too much waste and inefficiency in public schools. And even the slight majority of Oregonians who support more money for schools are what we would classify as soft supporters, meaning they could easily be pushed off that position. Now, Chalkboard's trying to spread good information, and our Open Books Project is designed to do that. We're really thrilled about the cooperation of the education community around that project. That's something everybody has agreed on, that more transparency is a good thing. And what that's doing is giving Oregonians a very neutral place they can go to be educated about where their dollars are being spent. But that's just one piece of rebuilding credibility with the public about these K-12 dollars. The next piece is really being able to say we are running every school with the most efficient business practices possible. So how do we get there? This bill proposes three specific initiatives that by the year 2014 would save $218 million annually. First, it creates a process for developing and sharing best business practices between districts and requires a review of every district's financial practices once every 6 years. Our proposal is different from the Senate bill on this point in that we believe every district, every ESD, should be reviewed once every 6 years. These are not voluntary audits. These are mandatory audits. Very small districts, those which are under 500 in average daily membership, could be reviewed as a group. We worry about voluntary reviews, and we think they're a way of reinforcing the status quo. We don't believe that will ensure that districts that need help cutting costs will actually get it. That's our biggest worry, is will those districts volunteer, and how do we make sure we can help them? We also believe there's a bigger point, that voluntary audits don't send the signal to the public that we're hearing them and that we understand we need to be able to account for all these dollars wisely. The savings we've identified are admittedly small in comparison to the overall K-12 budget, but they're monumental in terms of the message it sends to Oregonians that we're taking them seriously. I'm excited to tell you that Chalkboard is working with the Oregon Association of School Business Officials, OASBO, and we've already committed to a partnership where we will be funding voluntary audits through OASBO to build the process so that we can understand how the process can work, and we already have some districts who are willing to step up and be the guinea pigs while we do that. So hopefully if the legislature takes action on the audits piece, by the time you are done meeting, we'll have some infrastructure to work with. And then again, we want to make sure we tell the story of those audits to the public, and thus we intend to use Open Books as a vehicle to do that. The second piece of this bill of 2613 creates a process for reforming our transportation spending formula. For the next two school years, we propose temporary block grants to each district based on their previous year's transportation expenditures with some adjustments for fuel and other inflationary costs. And we're doing that really as an interim measure while we look at a formula redesign. And that's what we would really encourage you to focus on. The block grants are not the end goal at all. It was simply a means to get to what we think is the end goal, which is relooking at that formula. And at a minimum, looking at data, cost per mile and student density and student location, and all the factors that go in to creating a transportation formula that really works statewide. And we're encouraged that we are having communities across Oregon come to us and say they're really ready for that conversation. And we're encouraged that the governor and some other stakeholders are also willing to talk about a study of the formula. Finally, House Bill 2613 calls for incentives to expedite the elimination of districts' permanent early retirement programs. Traditionally, districts have had a lot of leeway in designing these programs, and we feel like we need to take another look at it. In theory, hiring less tenured staff with lower salaries to replace early retirees should offset the costs of early retirement programs. But many of these existing programs have become permanent and expected, which runs counter to the purpose of offering them in the first place. And as a result, most programs operating in Oregon fail to achieve a significant cost savings. Many districts are already phasing these programs out. We'd like to accelerate that process because during the 2004-05 school year, the state spent an average of $86 per student on these programs annually, and some districts spend more than $600 per student. So our bill gives districts until 2012 to bargain away permanent early retirement programs. After that time, the Department of Ed could reduce a district's state school fund allocation by the amount of early retirement dollars it's spending, except for those programs which are temporary in nature. So all told, these three bills from Chalkboard contain a total investment of $46.5 million in the 07-09 biennium. And because Oregon's economy has gifted us with additional resources, we feel like this is a perfect time, a perfect opportunity to start to put some of these real research-based reforms in place. And our message is very simple. Spend those dollars on proven reforms in a prioritized way, and at the same time, maximize the dollars we currently spend on teacher training, business operations. This concludes our formal comments on the three bills. We'd also like to put in the record an editorial that was in the Oregonian a few weeks ago advocating for mandatory audits of business practices and targeting of funds.
John, okay. No, we haven't received a copy of the editorial, is it?
It's attached.
Okay.
Yes.
So, committee questions for the panel.
Yes, just a moment. But that's all right. Representative is just fine. I'm honored to be a representative. In the first bill, let's see, I have to get my bill straight. In 2612 on page 2, section 3, it is line 36 through 41. Could you tell me a little bit more about the Start Making a Reader Today program and how does this program work and how do you know it's effective?
Nothing like starting out with a tough one.
The Start Making a Reader Today program is a reading program where adults volunteer their time to go into schools and read to kids. It's a nonprofit organization that many of our foundations have supported, continue to support today. We have looked at research that they've done. They have contracted out in various studies that have shown that their kind of one-to-one interaction with children is inspiring children to move forward with their literacy. So our point in including it here is it's an example of what school districts are doing to increase reading literacy in kids. Some schools are using smart tutors in all their classrooms. We know there's much higher demand for smart than there is the capacity to deliver.
Okay.
So in our model, we broke Oregon school districts really into two categories, those who would use SMART and those who would use paid tutors to increase reading literacy.
Okay. To follow up, sir?
Yes.
So this could be part of the supplemental services as provided under Title I, federal funds?
I don't know the answer to that. Do you, John?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Chair Roblin, for the record, I'm John Taponi. I'm a managing director of Echo Northwest, and I've been a consultant to the Chalkboard Project for almost 3 years and helped them work through some of the research on this. The intent here is that these resources would pass to school districts, and if they are already using federal monies or any other monies to offer one-on-one tutoring, this would supplement that in addition to those. And again, to build on Sue's comments regarding SMART, SMART certainly adds to the body of literature around one-on-one tutoring. But one-on-one tutoring along with kindergarten first grade class size reductions within the K-12 context are the two interventions that have been identified by academia and those that review large bodies of literature as the interventions that that have a strong connection to achievement gains.
Follow-up, sir?
Yes.
John, just to give me a little bit more of a picture, I used to always ask teachers, what would this look like in your classroom? And so what would it look like? Is this happening during daily instruction? Would it be before school, after school? The other part of that, and then I'm finished, is which in your research, because is there a grade level that it really has the biggest bang for its punch?
In the research that I've read, it is within the K-3.
Okay, so any of the grades.
The spectrum. Okay. And I think in terms of how it would look on the ground day to day, again, there are a lot of these decisions that are best left to principals and to teachers and the people running the schools. Certainly, in my observations in the school where my children attend, there are children pulled out of class periodically, taken to a library or a different setting, and given sort of the one-on-one attention as other children are doing other activities.
So it would come down to, again, the compatibility of local control with the concept.
With the notion also that there is research out there that I think the Oregon Department of Education should certainly disseminate and make all districts aware of. Some of the best research on one-on-one tutoring comes out of the Success for All program from Johns Hopkins University.
Without doubt.
And so certainly making sure that all teachers and administrators are aware of that practice wouldn't hurt.
Well, it's nice to see some of my research as a doctoral student being applied to policy.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you all very much for your work. Greatly appreciated. And Representative Comp, I can give one example of Bellevue Elementary School in Ashland. They do a practice they call flooding with the SMART program, where students from Southern Oregon University, members of the Chamber of Commerce, the Rotary Club, grandparents all show up at the same time to school, and they flood the school. So there are, and so I think it's from 9:30 to 11 every morning, and they have one-on-one contact in small groups on the green program. It has had tremendous results. I have a concern about this section, and I really appreciate the fact that the framework was given that you're willing to work and to get to the goal and not hold tight to any of these. And I guess my only concern is that in Section 3, Sub B, it does seem to indicate that SMART would be the only program that's actually put in statute. It seems to me that Section C does give school districts leeway to add additional programs. ODE is going to bring forth the results of the Reading First program. Those supposedly are going to be very beneficial programs as well. So I'm hoping that we might be able to work with that just to clarify that we're not cementing SMART in, even though it's excellent, but we're also leaving open for other programs.
Mr. Chair and Representative Buckley, I think we'd agree with that completely. The idea here was flexibility, and I think this is written a little too direct.
Representative Dolan.
Yes, I was concerned, but I think Representative Buckley handled it. I want to be sure that there's room for data-driven programs. I also wanted to take an opportunity to talk about, besides flooding, usually with the SMART program, you have a coordinating volunteer, and the volunteer works very closely with the teacher in the classroom, and the pullout is always at an appropriate time, so as to minimize the impact on whatever else is going on in the classroom. And having started into the program a lot of years ago with Gerald Wen's help, we're very pleased with it. But I want to be certain that data-driven programs that are yet to be born will have plenty of opportunity to be exercised under this statute. And they would.
That would be our intention.
Thank you very much.
Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Chair. I was intrigued, Sue, with a comment that you made about the difficulty, the challenge you found in trying to go out and assess other programs or come up with blue, determine what a blue ribbon reading program is when you looked nationally. And I wonder if you could expand on that and why you think it's not very easy to look around the country and come up with something that works.
Yeah, I will, and then I'll turn to my research expert, Representative Cannon. This was a disappointment to us, and what we took away from the experience was that the state of education research is not as deep as we'd like it to be, and it's actually a place where we're now talking about trying to make some investments because, frankly, Oregon maybe should have a research center in education, and certainly nationally, we were disappointed in what we found, and we did use a very tight criteria. We wanted the most research-based gold standards we could find. When we only found about half a dozen, we went back and said, okay, show us the promising practices and show us the innovations. And there's a great deal of exciting work going on there. They just don't have the validation that that first category does. And so what we're bringing to you is pretty much that first category. And the other things that we found in the innovation and promising practices area, we're doing pilot projects around, and we're testing ourselves, and we're evaluating them with rigor to see what we can learn there.
Representative Cannon, trust me when I say it was an uncomfortable several months as we started this process with Chalkboard, and we returned with our preliminary findings and recommendations around where they should start and where their priorities should be. I think there are two worldviews as to why the list of best practices isn't longer. And the first one was the one that Sue started with, which is we don't research K-12 education in the same way that we research in some other areas. In the healthcare field, in testing drugs, we routinely have controlled experiments where we'll give placebos to half and the real drug to the other, and we can follow them for many, many months and see who got better and who didn't. Even in the welfare-to-work world, there's a lot from MDRC and other East Coast research firms looking, providing services to half of a population, randomly not providing it to the other half, and then following their welfare experience, their tax-paying experience, et cetera, for five, 6 years after the fact. There's a lot of that sort of experimental work going on. When I was at the Congressional Budget Office, I used a lot of it in my cost estimates. When you get to this area, and there are good questions as to why it doesn't happen more, it may be that Americans are simply uncomfortable experimenting on children, and that they don't like to randomly assign half the children to a large class size, half the children to a small class size, and see what happens. Because at the end of the day, it is rather depressing to look at the Tennessee Star study and say, look, these kids that were in class sizes of 25 in first grade have a slightly higher incarceration rate when we go further down the road, and they have lower college attendance, etc. It's not very comforting to look at. So it's that lack of rigorous research design. I think another thing that plays into the lack of research is the fact that there are so many factors that affect educational outcomes and earnings outcomes, and school is a part of it, but it is not all of it. And there parental input, societal input, peer input, etc. The schools are very important, but they aren't the only piece. So if you don't do that very rigorous experiment and set all those other factors essentially equal, it's hard to measure it after the fact.
I'd just like to add kind of a historic perspective. The recognized value of educational research does not have a long history. Over the years, and I admit I was one of these people, over the years I think many of us who were teachers felt, we're in the classroom. We know what to do. We're on the firing line. Those people who are doing research are interesting ivory tower people. We have closed that gap substantially in recent years. And now there is a far greater recognition that well-conducted independent research on student learning is worth paying attention to. It just doesn't have an eon of history behind it. That may have some impact on why there isn't more immediately.
Sure, can I just make a follow-up comment? And that is, I appreciate your thoughtfulness and your all of your responses to this question, and I agree with you. I think that there may be an additional factor, which perhaps you've considered, which is also that very different things work in very different educational settings, and that one of the challenges we face when we try as state policymakers, certainly as federal policymakers, when we try to apply a single solution is that it doesn't work in all settings. And so I'm sensitive to, and I appreciate you addressing that tension between local control and trying to build some flexibility in here. I think it's very, very important for us as a committee and for policymakers to keep that continually in mind. But thank you, and I just wanted to raise that issue.
Representative Minnis.
Thank you. Sue, there seems to be a school of thought that your organization is a partisan organization, and so to explain to folks, not I think most people on this panel understands where you guys have come from, but for those that are on the Oregon Channel, would you just take a few moments and explain how Chalkboard came into being and who is involved in that, and for the benefit of all Oregonians that would watch this?
Mr. Chair and Representative Minnis, I appreciate that question because Chalkboard is very unique, and we are an independent, nonpartisan organization. We were founded by five of Oregon's leading foundations with very different philosophies, very different geographic location. Really, we like to say representing a lot of the diversity of Oregon, and they are the Oregon Community Foundation, which is statewide, the Collins Foundation, and the Meyer Memorial Trust based in Portland, the Ford Family Foundation in Roseburg, the Geldwin Foundation in Klamath Falls. Those are the original five funders, but we now have 15 additional foundations, mostly Oregon foundations, who've joined in to support Chalkboard. The Bend Foundation, the Woodard Foundation in Cottage Grove. It's a long list. And two national funders, the Gates Foundation and the Kellogg Foundation. And I like to describe this group as a group of Oregonians, and that's really what we are. We're aunts and uncles and parents and grandparents, and we really came together to say what more can be done here. We couldn't build a reform package that would meet everybody's philosophical view, and we didn't set out to do that. We set out to do two things: engage Oregonians in a quality debate around their schools and look at what works and try to see how those match up. So I would just say people have tried to pull us into various partisan discussions and races and campaigns. We've been pulled from the right and from the left, and I think we've stayed our course, which is we're an independent, nonpartisan organization looking at what works and what Oregonians want for their schools.
Representative Dolan.
My question is for you, John, and it's somewhat of a follow-up on Representative Cannon's question, because I want to pursue this just a little bit, because we have made major decisions. I concur with the in the classroom, that the teacher's there and knows those students and is assured that what they're doing is the best. Whether or not that's proven or not, I guess is another story. I also know that the ivory towers, I think that was a term used, have notions of what works best and what are best practices. But I want to go to the groups like us, the State Board of Ed, the legislature, even the people that fashion No Child Left Behind. What are they basing their mandates to education on? How are they arriving at the decision that school to work is good practice? Has anybody looked at that? How are they arriving at No Child Left Behind is good practice? If we only have a handful of identified and proven practices, I know sitting on this dais, I determined last year and voted, it was three more years of something. I think it was social studies if I had my way. how are these boards and commissions and people in authority, how are they determining? Have you looked at that at all? Because we certainly have no shortage of them.
That's true. Representative Dallum, there's a lot a lot that has been driven by No Child Left Behind. One of the things that has is an increased focus on some of these research practices. One of the original documents that we turned to was to identify K-1 class size reductions in tutoring was published by the U.S. Department of Education early on in 2003 as they were trying to sort out the research. They have since, as part of that process, started something called the What Works Clearinghouse, which people believe operates in to varying degrees of success. But in essence, what they're trying to do is to settle some debates in a variety of different areas. And so there's a website, the What Works Clearinghouse, where they have assembled research on a topic. They say this is the topic we're going to be looking at now. Academics from wherever, please send us in anything that you believe to be credible research. And then there is a panel that reviews the methodologies. They go across and they say, okay, look, this was done in a solid way. We've now found 15 or 20 of these that are sort of all pointing in the same direction. Maybe they don't have the same precise answer, but they're all saying, if you do more of this, it's a good thing. If you do, or it doesn't. And they're trying to add some clarity around which curriculum practices, which investments appear to have evidence behind them and which have less so. But there's simply very little out there that is as strong as the Tennessee Star experiment was. That is an anomaly in the education area. There simply isn't a lot of that type of true experimental design going on. So the rest of it is based on multiple. The best you can do is look at multiple studies and say, look, it looks like in multiple locations outcomes turned in the direction that we hope they would turn, and it looks like this is working. But you don't have sort of the definitive longitudinal backing that you do with K-1 class size reductions in tutoring.
More inductive than deductive.
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Minnis.
Mr. Chair, might I ask that? There was another piece to our research we haven't talked a lot about, but we also vetted a lot of this work with practitioners, with teachers, with principals, parents, students. I mean, we held 50 focus groups all over the state of Oregon, and we talked intensely about these ideas and tried to understand from the perspective of the practitioner, what did they think worked? Because we felt like there needed to be a balance between the academic research and the in-the-classroom research. And so we took both pretty seriously. And these emerge still. With the academic background, we still heard from practitioners, yeah, lower class sizes would make a big difference for these kids. Reading tutors would make a big difference. So that was an extra level that was involved in the process.
Okay. Representative Minnis.
Sue, I hope I'm not putting you on the spot, and I probably am by asking this, but if you had to prioritize, yeah, there's three bills here. What do you believe, as a panel, would be the most important achievement for this legislative session? I put you on the spot
already. All of these bills are important for our
that's a political response.
This is Sophie's choice.
We really do think you can do all of these this session, and we hope you will.
I believe we can as well. And with that, Mr. Chair, and I hope I'm not putting you on the spot, but do you, and I am, but do you anticipate that we'll have any action on these bills, or is this going to be just a hearing? And
I anticipate action.
Okay. Fabulous. All right.
Representative Trump.
I want to follow up with the direction that Representative Dahl was going in. Chair, Robin, boy, this call is really getting to me. John, some of us, I put myself in this camp, you know, as a doctoral student, I've become a snob about research. Mm-hmm. And so the information on what works Clearinghouse are these, what we call, are these reports, perspectives, are they refereed? And by that I mean, are there proven scientific procedures used in the research, and that's qualitative and quantitative, which is definitely more subjective. I mean, there are proven designs of research, and I know that the field of education does not have a breadth of research. That's why, you know, every school tries every strategy, and every 3 years the wheel changes, you know, and we keep retreading those tires. But so I'm kind of curious, before I go and spend a weekend on what works, what's the depth of the research?
Representative Kopp, it's actually a most of the studies that would be coming into the What Works Clearinghouse would have been refereed to begin with.
Thank you.
And so this is, in essence, sort of a second screening.
Okay.
And so they're looking across multiples and multiples of these studies, and then trying to decide. I mean, there are degrees of referee and, mm-hmm. and degrees of journal quality. Which of these were done well, and what are they saying? And generally, are the interventions pointing in the same direction, or can we get a direction out of this?
Right. Well, it's just some of the early research, in particular on the Success for All program, was completely unequivocally subjective with no data behind it. And some of us found that troublesome, as, you know, because I personally think Success for All is one of the most phenomenal reading strategies that you can use. But, you know, to see it, quote unquote, in a research journal as the end all, and at particularly early stages, it was very troubling to find that it was there wasn't any research investigation behind it. And so, like I say, I'm a snob. I'll admit it. But it's important. It's important to our practitioners so they know it's solid, good research.
Well, Representative Kopp, I have encouraged Charlie and Sue to be snobs as well. And that's why this is as short as it is.
Right. Seriously.
Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to belabor the research point just a little bit farther, because we are being asked potentially to essentially mandate. I understand there's more flexibility. You're not calling this a mandate. That's probably not quite the right word, but encourage certain practices in schools. And just to complicate it a little bit more on the research side, it very much matters what outcome you're looking for. And it takes something as simple as reading. Okay, it sounds pretty easy. Can the child read or can the child not read? Well, there are values associated with how you answer that question, or what type of reader are you trying to create? So the research, you know, a researcher says, boy, is the child reading or is the child not reading? It's a little more complicated than that. What kind of reader is the child? Is it a reader who can read the words on a page out loud fluently to an adult, but maybe isn't getting the understanding? Is it a child who is very active in storytelling and has that sort of vivid imaginative life that we hope our readers take and apply into writing? I just want to suggest to the committee and to you that it is important not to assume that these kinds of outcomes are, it's not like how do you make a more efficient microprocessor where we know, you know, one's more efficient than another. Sometimes it's not that easy in education either to compare one piece of research with another, because the outcomes and the values that go into that are so important. So it's just to complicate this question a little further, and you know, on these smaller class sizes, reading tutors, I don't think many practitioners would question the value that those things can provide, no matter what kind of outcome you're looking for. But know that even when we're talking about reading, different practitioners will have different kind, will bring different kind of values to that process. So that's my piece.
Representative Buckley.
I'll make a comment, probably not as lengthy as Representative Cannon. I'd like to extend my remarks in my response to Representative Minnis. And I believe Rep. Kopp will back me up, and we've had our discussion. We want to make sure everybody, in a similar spirit that Chalkboard has worked, to make sure everybody has a chance to comment on these bills. And we'll hold as many public hearings as we need to.
Excellent.
To make sure people have a chance to comment on the pros and cons of each one of them. And I truly do am grateful for the comments that Sue made right at the start about the willingness to work. Because there are parts of these bills, like, as Representative Cannon mentioned, I think that we can all jump on right now and say, fantastic. There are other parts that are going to be harder to work through. And so I am extending my remarks to say that we our intention is to work through.
Full commitment.
And to get to the exact same goals that I've expressed, to find out what works best and how, what we can do in this session to move forward what works best. So thank you for that opportunity.
I have a couple questions. The first one, you know, you hear from different people at different things, and this is probably to John more, and that is in the third bill we're looking at with respect to the accountability issues, I think that was the third one, we talk about transportation costs and compare it to Washington to Oregon. And I've heard from different people that that might not be comparing apples to apples and apples to oranges as opposed to the apples to apples. So can you give me information about how you did that and came to those comparisons?
Representative Roblin, the point on transportation, we first looked at cross-state comparisons, and National Center on Education Statistics collects information on student transportation spending. They do not collect information on the number of riders by state, so there you can go to the Student Transportation News, I believe, is the entity that tries to collect information on riders. And that information is not collected as rigorously or as carefully as NCES's information is. But that is the best you can do for interstate comparisons. We also looked within the state of Oregon, district by district, to see if we could compare how many riders you have, how much you're spending, how many miles are you carrying riders. And there the data aren't in very good shape either. There are a number of things you'd want to know that you don't, and some disparities in the data. So, for example, I can look at Beaverton's data on transportation spending and Portland's and the number of riders that they're providing. If I take the number of riders in Beaverton and I divide it by the number of students, I get a very high percentage, 75 to 80%. And that doesn't seem right given the density of Beaverton. It's well above average. When I did it for Portland, I got something like 10%. Well, that's not right because they're certainly transporting more than 10%. But what's going on in that data is that Portland's probably handing out TriMet passes and they're not counting them as riders. So I, to try to get my arms around, is somebody spending too much per rider or somebody spending too little, the state didn't have the data I needed to do that. Another thing you'd want to know if you wanted to figure out whether somebody was spending too much or too little is what share of students are you having to transport under special needs, physical special needs requirements? Well, the state couldn't tell me by district how many students are being transported under that kind of requirement. Certainly if there's a concentration of students that have severe physical disabilities that need special transportation requirements, that's going to cost the district more than if they don't have that kind of concentration. So that would be something that I'd want to know with a formula or in trying to understand cross-district expenditures. So then this sort of leads me to the biggest issue on transportation, and that is just the nature of the incentives that are in place. The incentives basic, or the way this works is the districts transport those that they are mandated to transport under state statute. They account for the money very meticulously that they've spent doing that, and then they submit the bill to the state, and state pays anywhere between 70% to 90% of that cost. Well, given an open-ended matching program like that, there is only one place in this state where there is an incentive to reduce the cost or to look for an efficiency, and that's right here at the state, because there is very little incentive at the local district to do so. If the local district works very hard, negotiates very hard, finds a dollar's worth of efficiency, that saves them 30 cents at best and a dime in the districts that get the 90-10 match. It's the same issues that you have in reverse and the actions that you take with Medicaid and the federal government, where you say, well, if we could just raise some more match, we'll get some more federal money. In essence, that's at play, and it simply doesn't give the incentive to the local districts, to the school boards, to the superintendents to look in that area to be more efficient.
Representative Buckley.
Just to respond, I do look forward to hearing from some school board members on this, because I know from my districts, if they can save a dime, they knock me over to save a dime. If they can save, you know, a penny, they knock me over to save a penny. So I do look forward to hearing their responses to that. And it's slightly different than in the healthcare field. We can use the healthcare money. We spread it out in different ways. I think there is a certain amount of oversight in using the transportation dollars. Unfortunately, we can't use the transportation dollars to hire that classroom tutor instead of doing the transportation. So I do look forward to the dialogue on that.
Thank you.
My other question, as I have received bills back, I have been somewhat surprised at times what my vision is when it comes back as a bill. They don't always seem to be the same. So, so my question has to do with one. My question has to do with one of the ones that is the most dear to me. To be open with everyone, I have been on a group of legislators who have worked with the Chalk Board for the last couple of years, and so and I have taken that as a privilege to have the opportunity to do that and to look at the information. So that, you know, just to let everybody know where that's at. But this one has to do with the collaborative, and for me, I have a vision of what that is. But I guess what I would like to hear is what the vision, as opposed to what this piece of paper says, is about the cooperative, and also. Clearly, in the discussions with Chalkboard, as you have done with audits and set up your own pilot projects, and money's coming directly from these foundations, you know, is there any commitment from the foundations with regard to this vision of a collaborative? So, I guess I want to get that on the record if there are. So, I'll leave it to whoever.
Thank you for the opportunity to respond about the collaborative. I'm Kate Dixon, and I'm working with the Chalkboard Foundation as an education policy specialist. And to some of you on the other side of the DS, know I've spent 37 years in education myself as a classroom teacher and a school administrator and other sundry positions along the way. And so this is really coming from I'm privileged to work on this with Chalkboard, and it's really been a labor of love and research. So it's really the collaborative is intended to be a way that we can capture and create long-term, effective, research-based, sustainable professional development for our teachers and our administrators across the state of Oregon. And I would say that at the macro level, we have a number of folks that are doing a lot of very good work around the state in the area of professional development. One of the issues that we deal with statewide, though, is we have a lot of start them up, stop, start up, you know, kind of revolving door work going on with professional development. And I applaud Chalkboard in their initial research and in their initial discussions across Oregon. This issue came up. Teachers and administrators said, we need better professional development in order to do the kind of work we're being asked to do in the classroom today. And so out of that initial engagement with educators and also the research, we've come up with a concept, and this is where Chair Roblin, I think you are right. There are ways that we want to make this bill stronger. We're open to working with our educational partners in doing that. But what we really want is that at the end of the day, we want to be able to have a process where we have an independent, private, publicly funded entity that can provide coordination, leadership, and support for very high-quality professional development across the state of Oregon. And so that's kind of it in a nutshell, and it's one of the some of you know Peter Senge's work. He wrote The Fifth Discipline, and he wrote about how learning organizations work, and it's about creating a system. And a system is different than a bureaucracy in the sense of, well, are we just creating another bureaucracy for Oregon? And a system provides a way for interdependent and related entities to work together as a whole. And this process would create a much more integrated way of providing professional development statewide. So that's kind of the, and it's that's the global answer. And Sue, I'm going to let you answer the money question,
sure.
And then we'll take more questions.
I should probably let Charlie answer the money question, but I'll dare to go first. Yes, the answer is yes. We've envisioned this as a public-private partnership, and we're prepared to put our part of the dollars on the table. But we wouldn't do it without the state part as well, because what we're trying to do here is accomplish a systemic statewide approach, and we think that means bringing the partners, state and others, to the table.
Since you mentioned money, I will say that this is something that we have committed ourselves to put dollars together for. And just this morning at our meeting, we were able to report that one charitable foundation in Oregon, not a part of our original five, made a commitment to this fund of $500,000. And another charitable foundation within our group indicated an intention to do $1.5 million. So there is commitment at the dollar level among us.
Mr. Jefferson, I would suggest we take up a collection. We can match.
We want the match, though. It needs to be a partnership.
Well, I just have to make a comment, Chair Roblin. If Representative Nelson was here, if you guys were veterans, the hat would be passed.
Other questions for this panel from the...
Can I just, if I may be so bold, I'd like to add one comment, and it's really in addition to the comments that were made about research and best practices. One of the components of the collaborative will be to advance research and best practice, particularly in the state of Oregon. We have, one of the things that's coming forward out of our own university system are better practices around research, and we need to understand the practices that we have happening in our own Oregon schools and the difference it's making in student achievement, and then be able to publish those. And that is very much a key component of the collaborative, is to advance research and best practices through very thoughtful research and best practices in our Oregon classrooms.
Other questions? Seeing that, I guess I'll end by just saying, you know, I have appreciated the opportunity to work with Chalkboard and look forward to continuing to work with them. And one of the things that I think has happened because of the involvement of Chalkboard and others, including the groups that are traditionally there for education, we are having much better discussions around the state about what we need to do for education. And we're talking about the things that can make a difference, you know, tutors in the classrooms, we all of the things that are embedded in these bills. They're beginning to happen in schools regardless of what we do here. And I think that conversation that was taken throughout the state has heightened the understanding of Oregonians about their education system. And I applaud that as well. So thank you. You might as well just go down this one.
These folks will talk on both of them.
Okay. So next we'll have our Education Coalition, Tricia Smith, Otto Schell, Lori Wimmer-Wayland, Chuck Bennett. And we're kind of going down the list that was on our House, the House Bill 2612, for the people that signed up. But you can talk about all three of them. All of them are open. So.
Thank you.
So you can talk about all of them, and that way we won't have to... Okay.
Nobody wants to go first, apparently.
Oh, have we? Okay.
Oh, that's great. And thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Lori Wimmer-Wayland, representing the Oregon Education Association and its 46,000 member teachers, community college faculty, and education support professionals. We're here today, and we'll talk about both bills, but I'll start with the one and then move to the other, because I've given you some documents that I worked at, because the way I like to think is by breaking down the chunks and making them manageable and looking at concepts and comparing and contrasting so that it's easier to wrap your brain around what the various ideas are that are competing for your attention in this building. And so that was my attempt, is to do that. Starting with House Bill 2612, I'd like to say that we really appreciate the fact that the Chalkboard Project has put so much time, research, resources, and so forth into trying to improve public education. We think that that's a wonderful thing. We're all glad that they care as much as we do about K-12 and, in our case, K-14. And so we're happy to have that opportunity to have those conversations. We don't have disagreements with whether some of these things should be done, but merely how. My mom always used to say, the devil is in the detail, and I'm trying to help provide you with some of the detail as dispassionately as I possibly could figure out to do it, that just went through each of the bills and our preferred versions of how as compared to Chalkboard's preferred version of how. I'd like to back up a little bit and explain to you who the Education Coalition is. You'll see a document that looks like this, this green pamphlet, and you'll see 9 organizations across the bottom. We're very proud to say that we have an unprecedented coalition effort around not only education funding, but policy linked to education funding, and most specifically, policy linked to student achievement gains and closing the achievement gaps. The members are the Oregon Education Association, COSA, OSBA, AFT Oregon, OSEA, Oregon Association of ESDs, the Oregon Small Schools Coalition, Stanford Children, and Oregon PTA. And what we've done is we've taken the school improvement fund that we were all parties to creating back in 2001, which we saw as bicameral, bipartisan, consensus document, consensus law that made it into the statutes and was actually funded before the recession hit Oregon. And we have taken that and taken the work of the Senate Educational Excellence Commission, which met during the interim and produced with citizen input, again, bipartisan, and again, with citizens involved in it, business people and others, a way to take a look at accountability and all kinds of other issues around education, and produce 3 bills that, this is one of them, Senate Bill 318, that we all supported. And what Senate Bill 318 is another way to look at improving the school improvement fund that's in statute. And what it is it kind of updates and upgrades it, but maintains local control and flexibility and so forth. And this document shows you how the various proposals aligned with those, which are, by the way, aligned with the quality education model. Everything is in sync with your laws and the Education Act of the 21st century. Why start over and reinvent the wheel when you've got good basic policies in place, is our thought. These actually take you on a per-student purchasing menu. You can take a look at all of those student improvement outcomes. You can see what they cost per student to achieve, and districts can look at the school improvement fund, determine which is the highest, most vital priority for their district, and select from among them. That's what Senate Bill 318 will do. It was passed unanimously out of the Senate Education Committee last month. It's winging its way to you, and we would ask that you wait and take a look at that and compare it, as we've done in our chart here, with House Bill 2612, and look at the elements. Now, with respect to the piece about limited choices versus more expanded flexibility, I'd like to make a comment about that. Since 1999, Oregon's K-12 system has lost $1.2 billion. That's nearly $1,800 per student. And the school improvement fund, as we envision it, and this is integral to our $6.3 billion ask, it's the $300 million school improvement fund package, that's just $208 coming back out of that $1,800 loss. Now, school districts, 197 school districts, coped with the ways to make those cuts differently. In some places, what they'd like to restore first is maybe an early education initiative, literacy, write down class size, full day kindergarten, something like that. In another place, maybe it's an ELL question. There's students who, for whom English is not their first language, and that's where their most urgent need is. Or maybe it's dropout prevention. Maybe they have an abnormally high rate, and they'd really like to retain those students and put more work there. This isn't about not being responsible or keeping your eye on the bottom line of best practices or research. All of these proposals align, as I said, with the quality education model and best practices research. And you'll see in that document that we've cited that research for every one of them. So we would ask that you take a look at this other bill, which attempts to achieve the what the same way, the weather, if you will, but the how is a little bit different. And we think also a much more meaningful level of investment. You'll understand when I say ours is a $300 million school improvement fund. Just like in 2000, it was a $220 million school investment fund. The one before you would be, I think, $40 million. So this would be significantly more in that regard. We think that the flexibility has to be a core principle in order for those districts to be able to also consider local culture. I've heard from a lot of schools east of the mountains that they've gotten rid of their voc ag programs, and for those communities, keeping kids home and in their community is part of their economic development long-term plan. And so when those kinds of programs get cut out and students choose other options, oftentimes it means they leave the neighborhood, so to speak, to find jobs elsewhere, to find education and training elsewhere. And so this is about maintaining those stable communities, too, especially in rural areas. So, again, we and vocational education, by the way, is one of the elements in the school improvement fund as it is currently constructed and as it is envisioned by Senate Bill 318. If you don't mind, I'll just move on to my testimony on the other bill, and then
quick question.
Pass it. You want a quick question?
Okay. Yeah. Sure. Laura, you made the comparison of 318 to 2612, but doesn't some of the components you have listed in 318, aren't they included in some of the other bills that are before us in 2613 and 14? Maybe they're not in 12, but are they in the other bills? Some of those.
Chair Roland, Representative Minnis, I was up to 1:30 doing these, so I think I compared the right bills to each other. I am willing to be corrected if I'm wrong, but I think this chart is the one that connects.
Yeah, it's
to the
not
other
a
one.
Correction. I'm just asking if those some of these other components in 318 might be contained in some of the other bills that are before us today.
It was not my understanding that they were. I've read every word of the all bills. Right. I think you'll see that in this one.
Thank you.
Okay. To House Bill 2613, then, if I may. Again, not whether, but how. The Senate Education Chair Lee Walker asked me to convene last month a work group to align and conform two different and vying proposals for performance auditing and accountability for school districts. And we had been quarreling over this, shall we say, for 6 years. The Secretary of State's Audit Division had one vision, and again, the Senate Educational Excellence Commission that met in the interim had another vision. And I'm proud to say that in 60 minutes we got the job done, and we had a bill that took what we believe to be the best elements of both, and it isn't a gotcha, it's a showcasing of best practices so that districts can hear about from each other what it is they're doing out there and adopt those practices and also have some remediation where ideas are found. But it is a formal performance audit with subpoena power and all of those other things, which we believe gives it credibility. I saw an editorial a week or so ago that made the case that if it's voluntary, nobody has to pay attention to it. And I push back on that. I think if it's voluntary, it just means that the folks who really feel that they could benefit from it are going to be the first ones in line to have that done. And it's significantly less expensive when you do it that way as well. You might know that when the ITACS was passed in Multnomah County, there was an audit piece associated with the receipt of those monies for the 3 years. And it is our understanding that all the districts who participated in it really felt they learned a lot from it and had very positive experience, and that word's gotten out as well. And I'm very proud of my colleagues because we had the Secretary of State in the room in this work group, we had the Governor's Office, we had the Department of Education. We had all the education stakeholders. We were able to come to an agreement that everyone embraced. Again, unanimous vote, bipartisan, out of the Senate Education Committee, and it, too, is winging its way to you. And we would assert that this might be a better approach to go. It certainly is. We would argue that voluntary does not mean you're not going to pay attention to it, and it doesn't mean you aren't going to find problems, and it doesn't mean you aren't going to be able to share solutions. We really did like, however, the idea of the showcasing of best practices that is found in House Bill 2613. We think that that was a nice addition. We didn't have in our bill, and to the extent that having some sort of, I don't know if it needs to be certified and all the paperwork and annual reporting and all that stuff, but if there is a way that we could preserve that concept, we'd certainly be very open to doing that, because and we've shared that with Chalkboard. We believe that the proposal before you today, however, does have a lot of cost, a lot of shells instead of mays, a lot of bureaucracy, and a huge fiscal impact that we think will probably go beyond the $4 million, because if you just put a yellow line through every bill that says the Department of Ed staff will provide staffing to this committee or that work group or this, you know, everything else that they've got as far as functions in the bill, and I would ask this committee to do this, ask for a fiscal impact on what that'll be for the department to do all these new functions, because it's been my experience in my 16 years in the building that when you have those sentences, as innocent as they may seem, you've created a whole new workload for the department, and they will probably be able to tell you what their estimate would be of what that might cost the state in addition to the $4 million for hiring the technical assistants to do the financial review and so on. So those are the thoughts that we had on the two bills, and I'll turn it over to my colleagues now. Thank you.
Any other questions for that part?
Would we want to wait for the panel? Let's wait. We'll let
okay.
you all.
Great. Chair Roebling, members of the panel, my name is Otto Schell. I'm the Vice President for Legislation with the Oregon PTA. I'm part of the coalition that's referenced on the page that has been going around visiting the legislative leadership and talking to them about this plan. We believe in this plan. We think it has a lot of benefit, a lot of opportunity to do things in different communities, different ways, and benefit kids. Early in the session, I was admonished by several of your colleagues, because I am a PTA person and I'm representing a lot of parents who can't come down here regularly, keep asking, how is this good for kids? And I have to tell you, I ask myself over and over in the context of this, and I think we've got a plan that is good for kids, that provides a vehicle for you to help those folks who actually deliver the services in the communities to do really good things and to benefit kids in every part of the state. To give a little background, PTA is a volunteer-driven membership group, about 22,000 members statewide. We're in big towns and little communities all around the state. We have a 100-year history here in Oregon of advocating for kids. We're not just the bake sale and cookies folks. We do a lot of things in a lot of communities to try to make things better for kids, and that includes coming to this building and talking to you all. Also, we've been active with Chalkboard, so that the folks, Representative Minnis reminds me to tell the folks who are watching this on the Oregon Channel, we have been working with Chalkboard on a lot of different things, and we've appreciated them asking us to help them, and we thank them for things like the Open Books Project. We were the people who showed up on the opening day of Open Books and went in and demonstrated how easy it was to do that, to compare district by district where the money goes. Because one of the problems, and it's come up in the testimony today, is public perception isn't what the facts are. The facts of how things are done in schools, how we spend our money, is really out of sync with public perception. And I'm with Mr. Walker and the other folks who, if we don't get this going in the right direction, that Oregon could head to the backwater status. I think that it's really important that we work to get the facts out and not repeat public perception as if they are facts. That's one thing that parents talk about all the time, and they talk about with teachers and administrators too, and it's a big deal for changing how people see public schools in Oregon. It's a national problem, but we seem to have our own special version. We have also been involved with Chalkboard on issues of parent involvement. We applaud that they made grants to various communities to bring technology to the buildings to help parents integrate electronic computer-based technology to track your kids' grades, to do things like that. Those are really good things. We would like everybody to have that opportunity, and we're a long way from doing that. I personally have been delighted to hear business leaders, foundation leaders, talking about giving employees flexibility to volunteer. Because when you're talking about building a mentoring program or any kind of reading program, and you're going to build it on volunteers, my antenna go right up, because volunteers can't sustain that unless they have huge flexibility, and there has to be a commitment from the state, from the government, but also from business. If you're going to rely on those volunteers, even well-intended volunteers, they got to be able to show up, they got to be able to deliver the goods over and over, because it's not like having a teacher in the classroom or an aide in the classroom. We appreciated that Chalkboard has talked about the need for stability on school funding. I also appreciate that they're willing to talk about adequacy, and we need to get to talking about adequacy sooner than later. They have also been, they were surprised, as were many people who don't know about the limitations of what we can do in this state, that the Department of Ed didn't have the ability to do the parent involvement assessment. They stepped up, they gave the money, and we were involved in some of those discussions, and we appreciate that. All that said, when I come and I listen to the plans that are being rolled out, I worry a lot about the distancing between a state layered on plan and the community. I spent last weekend with the Oregon School Board Association and the COSA folks, came down, sat and had dinner and interacted with a lot of school board people. Those people, like Representative Buckley said, if they can save a dime, they'll save a dime. And we need to push back on that mythology about waste, fraud, and abuse. It's a problem. We just can't repeat that over and over, because even if Oregonians think it, it doesn't make it so. And it's really important that we get our hands on that. So the other concern that I would have is that if you're going to divert from the plan that we've laid out for you, that the overuse of the word accountability and short timelines is a disservice to teachers. It's a disservice to the community. You have to be really careful about expecting results in a 9-month pattern. That we didn't get to this place in a short run. We won't get out of this place in a short run either. We have to be really smart. We have to not do the startup shutdown programs. Parents are waiting on you, on us, to do the things that move us in the right direction. So those are the cautionary things I have for you. Parents are committed to working on this. We will help you when we can, but the truth is we need leaders at the top to take it forward, and Chalkboard's providing some of that leadership, and we appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Mr. Chairman, I don't have anything in particular to add to the discussion that's occurred around the specifics of the bills. I think Lori has done her usual remarkable job of tearing it apart and putting it back together in a way that we can all look at and understand what the components add up to. And I certainly agree with her conclusions and the conclusions from my friend Mr. Schell. Mr. Chairman, I guess the only thing I would add is just a genuine admiration for the work that Chalkboard has done from our organization's perspective. The level of conversation around education over the past couple of years has risen exponentially to the amount of time, effort, money, and talent they have brought to the table. Sometimes those of us who are in the education process have a difficult time getting the discussion to the level we've reached today. At times we try, but we get trapped in kind of the pitfalls of money and turf and old rivalries and issues. And I think what Chalkboard has brought to us has been a new and different way, and I think has of discussing it and heightened the conversation and heightened the level, I think, of thoughtfulness that's gone into it. Doesn't mean they're right. I don't misunderstand me. I certainly agree that there are some real differences here. But being right and wrong in this discussion is not what this is all about. It's that we're talking about improving and developing the education of children into the 21st century and into a century in which they compete with children in other parts of the world who are taking this very, very seriously. And Chalkboard, I think, has added to the seriousness and kind of the gravitas of the discussion. And for that, I think we're all grateful. And we certainly will take from this discussion, I think, all of us, you as policymakers, us as advocates, a renewed ambition that for the next decade or two, until it all starts to go back to maybe the more mundane discussion we've been trapped in for what at least struck me as the past 30 years, that we'll keep this thing at a heightened level of conversation. And I can only say that if you look at nothing else, if Chalkboard had done nothing else but open books, they would have served our community very well. It is a remarkable project and one that I think can inform citizens beyond their expectations if they'll visit. So we really, you kind of hate to be here saying great guys, but we're kind of here saying great guys, but. and in spite of that, please continue to be great guys. That they've really done a great job. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent the 20,000 members of Oregon School Employees Association. I'm happy to be here with you today on these bills. I am going to try not to repeat what my colleagues have said. So I will say that we are in full agreement with Ms. Wimmer-Wayland's points on the School Improvement Fund. As she said, our districts have over the last very few years received draconian cuts in their budgets, and they have made horrendous choices as a result of that lack of funding. And our children desperately need us to begin to restore those cuts so that their educational programs can be restored as well. And we believe and we understand that it's important to this body as the major funder of education at this point to be able to target some of that money so that you can see that indeed some of it is going to things that you think are particularly important for the child's education. But we also believe that the prescription in House Bill 2612 is too restrictive for districts to use to their best ability to educate all children within the district. A district doesn't get to choose to only educate the younger ones. They have older ones that have been in the district, and most of their educational experience has been during these cut years. And some of them need music, and some of them need art, and some of them need a science program that works for them. And so we can't leave them alone. We can't abandon them further while we're trying to help the young ones. We need to help the young ones, but we also need to help the old ones. The school improvement plan, as we have outlined it, we believe gives districts the maximum flexibility and the legislature the maximum amount of accountability, if I may use that word just once, to show that
it's not a swear word.
It depends on the time of the day or night, Representative Minnis. Sometimes it is for me. But nevertheless, we have been in this building introducing bills of our own to try to establish some accountability in schools because we know that the true funders of our schools, the people who live in our communities, want that. They want their children to have the best education they can have. And that's exactly what we want as well. And so accountability is not bad. You're right. But the true accountability is what's happening to our children and whether or not they are going to have what they need to go out in the world and succeed as humans the way we want them to. And that's not just the little ones, it's also the big ones. So with that, I'll move on to 2613. Again, I'll try not to repeat what you've heard before about this bill, and instead I want to focus on a piece of it that deals with an issue that's near and dear to the hearts of many, many OSEA members, and that's the transportation funding grant. We haven't had any chance in this committee to talk about school buses, darn it. But boy, could we. The truth is, if a child doesn't get to school, he doesn't get an education. In Oregon, we mandate that all children go to school. They don't get a choice. Parents don't get a choice about whether or not their kids go to school. And these days, here in Oregon and in the rest of this country, most parents don't get a choice about whether or not they're going to be able to drive their child to school. Most of them can't. Their kids go to school at different times, and they go to work, and they are so glad that someone else is going to transport their children in a safe manner to and from school, so that isn't something that they have to deal with. According to my folks who do this for a living, if you want to upset parents, tell them you're going to keep the school buses from running. They like school buses, and we do too. Student transportation in school buses is the safest way, in addition to the most effective way. It is the safest way to get kids to and from school. It's far safer than a passenger car, walking, transit buses, anything else. The reason for that is because the federal government regulates school buses more than any other vehicle that's on the road. With good reason, they've got our kids in them. School buses are important to schools. Student transportation is important to schools. This bill suggests that a committee evaluate the cost-benefit of transporting students to and from school. I would suggest to you that you don't need someone to study that. You know that already. It's very important that we transport students to school, and you've seen no evidence to the contrary come to this building. In addition to that, we have what I would suggest to you is a very efficient mechanism for funding student transportation. We only fund those costs at the state level that have been approved, that are real student transportation costs. And they look at those when they submit the reimbursement forms to determine, the Department of Education does, to determine whether or not those costs are approved costs under the law. And they're very limited in what those costs can be. I don't get paid to defend superintendents or transportation managers, but I feel that I must when I hear that this funding mechanism breeds inefficiency. That tells me that one assumes that the persons implementing transportation at the local level are looking for ways to be inefficient. And they're going to be inefficient unless you make them be efficient by messing with their money. Now, when you're talking about student transportation, my folks say, other than how many bus barn managers does it take to manage a bus barn, it's pretty tough to get more efficient in transportation because the school district doesn't determine how much the gasoline costs or how old the buses are or how much maintenance they require or where the students live. All they can do is deal with those kids as they come and try to provide the best transportation they can. The areas in the state where the state pays the most money for student transportation at 90% are those areas that are the most rural, where the school districts have the least ability to fund their transportation program without taking horrendous amounts of money out of the classroom. That's why we fund them at 90%, to keep money in the classroom where it belongs. Student transportation is, I would submit to you, a very efficient part of our budget. It may be low-hanging fruit when you need money for something else, but I would suggest to you that it would be a tremendous mistake to change the way we fund student transportation or to change whether or not we fund student transportation and whether or not the school district should be mandated to provide student transportation. When that mandate came about in 1991, schools said, "We're not bus companies, we're educators." I understand that. They're not bus companies, but they've got great transportation programs now in their districts because they understand that getting kids to school is the first thing you have to do if you want to educate them. And in this world, if we don't have school buses bringing them, lots of kids won't get there. I could go on and on, but I won't. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate... Oh, one other thing. The state of Washington has been mentioned here in their transportation program. The state of Washington just issued a report on pupil transportation funding, and in their report they said there are no best practices in funding methods, but there are best practices in operating practices. Our bill on that Ms. Wimmer Whalen suggested to you, Senate Bill 47, that deals with best practices in business services, including transportation, is a place I look forward to finding those best practices, getting them down, and then providing them to those districts who may not know those best practices yet. And we think that is a terrific improvement in the way our folks do business. So with that, I will leave it to you for questions. Thank you, Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Okay. Questions? Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony, for coming forward, and your passion for public education. Ms. Merrill-Wayland, maybe I can toss at you. I've worked for a number of years in a variety of theater organizations that had to be audited on a yearly basis. Part of that came because we received a lot of money from grants, et cetera, and we had to prove, again, we had to show that we were using that money legitimately. In making audits voluntary, I know the organizations I worked with have said, we don't want to do them, we'd rather not do them, simply because of the effort. It took us away from our primary mission, which was the creation of theater. Isn't there a danger that a school district is going to say, our primary mission is, we're focusing on education, please leave us alone, and we don't want to participate in an audit. Yet, given the testimony today and what we know to be the perception of now that our schools are wasteful, even though I believe it's not true, that is perception, is not a mandatory audit a step we should take in order to show to the people of Oregon we're using these dollars exactly as they should be used?
Mr. Chair and Representative Buckley, that's a great question. And I've got a couple answers for you. First of all, I think it's important to distinguish between financial audits and performance audits. We already have a law that requires annual municipal audits of all school districts every year. So that's already being done. That's not voluntary. That is mandatory. Performance auditing is another thing entirely, which we think is better than financial management. Right. And because it goes a little deeper and it goes to some other kinds of things. It goes to the kinds of cost savings that we're all hoping to show the public that that schools are already engaged in, and show each other, district to district, how to do it better, where those best practices can be showcased. And I would also say that in the give and take of the compromise that it was my job to try to bring, reconciling the two bills, that was a pretty fundamental piece. I think that probably in a couple years, it probably could move in that direction. Once performance audits are a matter of what we do as a matter of course, and a number of districts are saying, hey, this really worked out well, I learned a lot of stuff. As I said, the Multnomah County school districts had apparently said, I know, and Mr. Bennett will probably say this to you too, that they've already got a long list at COSA of people who are stepping to the plate who want to go forward with this. And so I just didn't think it was a piece that we had to hang on to in the give and take of this process. And then the final thing I wanted to say is, when you audit 20 ESDs and 197 school districts every 6 years, and if the audit doesn't conform to what Chalkboard thinks is the best practices, which is the way the bill works, and then you have to come back in every 3 year, or in the third year out after some district is found to be non-conforming. So you're either doing 3 or 6 year audits of all of us. That's a phenomenally expensive undertaking. I just would say that if all I did is to save money, that's a lot of money to invest, with the hope, not the promise, the hope that enough efficiencies will be found to pay back and then some. And we just don't know that the speculation about $200 million being out there to find, I think that's all on the transportation side, frankly, that at least those were the estimates I heard in an interim committee testimony. I'm not sure that we are not just rolling the dice and hoping for the best after having such a colossal investment.
I was going to actually volunteer Representative Cannon to personally do the audits.
I don't see the question, but I guess an analogy and a question embedded in the analogy for all of you. You know, from my perspective, 1991-92 was our state's Katrina. It didn't make the headlines like Katrina, but if you watch what happened here at the legislature and then watch what happened to schools because of the downturn in our economy and that loss, it had the same kind of effect, though quietly and differently in each community. And being a principal at the time and watching things go away and having to change what schools were doing, one of the things, because I tend to be an eternal optimist, was to say, you know, we have a great opportunity here. We are not going to have as much as we had before, so what we have to do is we have to figure out how to do it better. So I believe a lot of the efficiencies were made during those times, and I would love to see the odds to show that. But I also came to the conclusion that when the money came back, maybe it shouldn't go back in the same places it was before, because maybe we weren't doing things as well as we should for student achievement. And so from my perspective, it's like building a house. And if you don't have a good foundation for that house, and if you don't make sure that's shored up, putting all the other stuff on top of it makes a mess. And so, you know, when I see too many options sometimes, when I know something is a good foundational program to get it to all work, when I know we're still, from my perspective, a billion short with respect to what we should be putting into schools to do what we should be doing, then when you start rebuilding, mightn't we all look more closely at what is that foundation that we have to build back so that eventually we get a system that can sustain and it does the right things for all kids? And because I know that there are pressures from in every school district for the particular thing they used to do the best. And it was a wonderful thing. And that's, if they have the money, that's what they want to put it back. And I hate to tell people, it'll never be the same. I mean, we lost the stuff that helped us get there. And so when you put it back, you might be disappointed in the final analysis. So isn't it important to look and to maybe identify those fundamental building blocks that are there, as opposed to, you know, giving lots of options to people to build a foundation for the house? I guess I'll leave it at that.
Mr. Chairman, you know, you mentioned the most recent devastation that hit education. I served during a previous one in the early 80s, when we saw the timber economy decline so dramatically. And I recall that was the period when we had a daughter in the school in the Mill City School District, which was a timber community that I represented, part of it, and we lost everything.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing left with them. The concept of even having blocks to build with becomes, you know, really an attractive opportunity for some of those communities. And you know this. You saw it down in your neck of the woods as well, and you were involved at the same time. And what happened after that, and what is happening now, is local communities evaluate their student body. They evaluate with their communities what does get added back, what needs to be added back for the future of those kids, and seem to be pretty successful. We were able to successfully do it after the 80s. I think we can successfully do it now. And I guess I just suggest that the list, at least that we've included in 318, certainly isn't inclusive of what's been lost out there as communities began to pare back. And in talking with administrators and with school board members, I think there is an absolute, I mean, I think you're right on the mark, that administrators especially appreciate that programs that may have been popular, less than popular, whatever, extraneous, even potentially extraneous, were lost. And some of those aren't coming back. And they don't want, in some school districts, they don't want them back. That doesn't mean there isn't an advocacy group for each of them. But under 318, we think we have gone to the heart of the matter by referencing the quality education model as the base point from which we're suggesting any building back a curb because it has some real achievable goals. It's very clear what the funding is for and what the outcomes are. So we're feeling pretty comfortable that the list we're offering is certainly not a Sears catalog list. This is real limited. This is a very targeted group of opportunities for spending. So I guess in the two ways, one, we think our list is that, and number two, just from my own experience, I guess, and from talking with others in this profession, there is no inclination not to build back with real understanding of where we're going. And also, though, I don't want to understate the sense of loss all school districts feel for the programs they lost, particularly those they were really great at and will never get back. Whether it's the wonderful PE programs we had for all kids and libraries that we had available all the time with librarians, and gosh, even an assistant librarian now and then when a school district was really flush. You know, I mean, you can go down the list, and you know the list as well as I do. We do miss those days. We do miss all of that. They still miss it in Mill City. And as long as timber remains outside of the, well, I won't go into timber.
You can stay around for the next committee.
We'll save that for the next committee. We'll see that in Mill City as well. So.
Chair Roblin, the only other thing I would say from the perspective of the parents is we've been scrambling, raising millions and millions of dollars to put some of those things back in a very haphazard way. It is a bad way to run schools in a patchwork way. It results in inequities, potentially. It gives the herky-jerky, I forget, someone was describing the start it up, shut it down, start it up again. That's happening all over, even in the places that have more local resources. And the other thing that I keep, when I hear these discussions, I carry this little pamphlet around. It's from 2002. It's the Quality Ed Model. The Quality Ed Model tells us how to do these things. The list that, I don't want the people watching the channel to misunderstand that we're not giving school board leaders, school boards and superintendents, a funny list of herky-jerky stuff. We're giving them really basic, important things. One thing is if we want to reduce class size statewide, it's $200 million. That's COSA's number. You can't get very far if that's your primary goal, is to reduce K-1. It's on third page or the middle of the book. It's $200 million. That's a big deal. And if we're advocating for 6.3, and you take 200, you're at 6.1, so there's not a lot of fluff that, you know, if people are worried that some district's going to do something silly, that's not what we're doing. That's not what this proposal's about. So if when you get a chance to look at it more carefully, you'll see what we're asking.
And as a final point, Mr. Chair, I will say that the best practices outlined in the QAM are research-based practices. Nobody made them up over there. They are research-based practices. And they were designed for one thing, and that's student achievement. As you sit here, your one demand of schools should be student achievement. I think it would be very difficult for you sitting here to know how 198 school districts are going to provide achievement as the federal law requires they must and state law requires they must to every student to continue to advance in their education if you are too prescriptive in how that school district must do it.
We're probably going to, I don't know if we have any more questions, but it is past our time. So,
Mr. Chair.
But we are going to keep this going to the next Tuesday, so we'll carry these over. There will be more time, and those people who were not here, I hope you can all come back. And we may even start, if there's any questions to you, at the beginning of the next time, if you guys can be here.
Sure.
Any other questions?
Yes. Just the acceptance of some testimony by one of our people in the audience, Marilyn Dials, about charter schools. I want to make sure you all have a copy of that for your files.
And can I close them off?
Sure.
I will close the hearings on House Bill 2612, 2613, and 2614. And any other issues? I will close the meeting of the Education Subcommittee on Education Innovation.
Just have a safe trip down to Ashland.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. We post these three. We're going